I'd like to start with a poem that begins, Michael mentioned the Conspiracy Quartet, which is really a book-length poem in four parts. That's sort of my imagined history of paranoia and conspiracy theory, American style, in the 20th century. So we worked through CIA, LSD experiments. We worked through the crash saucers of Roswell. We worked through a number of things. But it starts simply and literally at home with a guy you'll meet as Uncle Bud. The poem is Enough. Uncle Bud would always swear they had a pill you could drop into the gas tank, and miraculously, you'd be talking 200 miles to the gallon. But no, they were not about to let that out. That was something he knew for sure. He'd read it in a magazine, and it turned into one of his favorite theories. Those flimsy sticks he rubbed together, trying to light up the dark. They worked so hard to keep him in. Sundays, we passed the mashed potatoes around the table for their pale, watery lesson. Just when we think we can't take any more, there we are, in spite of it all, helping ourselves. Bud loved dreaming up other people's secrets, letting us know he was onto something big this time. It put a dollop of hope into his hapless days. They breathed the same planet's air as he did, and they had power, cigars, prestige to burn. The one time I actually managed to whisper, "Enough's enough," I wasn't sure who I wanted to hear it. My uncle, my mother, in the relentless bounty of her kitchen. The inexplicable blue sky. That's what they'd like you to believe, he said, so don't. And right before Pi, I stood corrected. You'll find out too much is not enough, not nearly in this life. Each Sunday, we watched him pull away in his dilapidated Buick, looking incredibly smaller behind that wheel than he'd seemed the week before. No one wanted to tell me he was dying, that cancer cells arranged his doing in. At first, a vicious rumor slowly spreading, then turning more insidious and true. He had to know the pain, if not the reason. No doctors in cahoots would ever get their hooks in him, gladly take too many days of his hard-knock salesman's money for x-rays and needles and biopsy slides that only might confirm what he'd secretly been feeling all along. There's nothing we can do. And I remember thinking, if there truly is a pill, it would be only fair to let him have it, finally, no questions asked. How much could it hurt? And he wouldn't have to stop and ask directions he never quite trusted, or resign himself to another $3 of regular and hope he wouldn't run out before he made it halfway to anywhere. In theory, just this once, he could drive himself crazy, elated, unbelievably whole, and keep on going, humming along with the steady engine, a secret at last, sized so exactly to his heart's desire that maybe he'd find himself feeling like one of them for a minute. And for a minute more, at least, that would be enough. And having gone as far as he could, almost off the map, falling into blue, maybe then he'd really pull over, kick off his dependable shoes, all in due time, forever. And I knew It wouldn't be Uncle Bud without one of the bad habits he couldn't break. Swearing, his luck had changed into something more comfortable and good. So I imagined him spitting into that ocean, still intent on making his small difference, even in the face of his own ridiculous dying. Waiting out the dark, the rising tide, staking every one of his feverish claims all over again in the sand, at the edge of the knowable world. A new book of poems that comes out next month is called Jack Ruby's America. And it is kind of an imagined life, not of so much conspiracy and paranoia, but a Chicago Jewish immigrant street kid, Jacob Rubenstein, who ends up orphaning through the streets of Chicago to meet his date with history in the basement of the Dallas jail on November 24th, 1963, 2 days, of course, after the Kennedy assassination. This is a monologue, a short monologue from that book called Jack Ruby Talks Business with the New Girl, The Carousel Club, November 21st, 1963. I will say this only once to you, I promise. Business is business. It's nothing personal. All business is good business. You heard of selling the sizzle, not the steak? Be sure you're only sizzle, nothing but. They're hungrier than that. They can beat it somewhere else. I run this place so clean, some nights people hear it squeak. Smile all you want, but no life stories ever. I never knew a smile that hurt, but keep your real name yourself. And when you hear whatever name you're dancing by tonight, it's your turn. And you dance with class, like nobody's business. You make your entrance, hit your mark, and get it done. And let's face it, the music isn't much, but it's all yours. Do what you can. And somebody thinks he knows how to soften you up with sweet talk or a roll of bills, remember, you always know better. This is no business to make that kind of mistake in. Take it from me. You don't want to walk into anything you can't talk your innocent enough way out of. And if there's trouble you didn't see coming, don't worry. That's what I'll be out there looking for. I may be incognito, just another hat in the crowd, but if you want to know the truth, all you have to do is ask. You say, Jack, and I swear I'll come through, say the word, and some guy's good as dead. He'll learn fast. Guys like him are our business, and who we are is really none of his. As long as you're working for me, you're covered. Partners, no matter how that has to mostly seem. Yeah, you're the one who's out there at point blank range, but I will never leave you twisting in the wind, whichever way it's blowing that night, alone in any of this business. I worked for 5 years in the summers as a wait guesser at the Jersey Shore. Wait guessing is about the only part of the midway at the Jersey Shore or in a good old-fashioned carnival racket that isn't gaffed, that is to say rigged. The high striker, the fortune tellers, and so on. But the person who's working as a wait guesser, there's no gimmick. You learn how to do it, and there's no fix in. The person's job then, after you've guessed the weight, to prove you right or wrong is to hop up on the scale that you've got. And there's no way you can fix a scale on an ever-shifting mob. This poem is called On the Eve of His Retirement, The Weight Guesser Goes All Out. For the Jersey Shore Boardwalkers, circa 75, and for the great Detecto himself. In her fortune teller's booth, Madam Starlight pretends to traffic in some version of a future no one ever saw coming. But she's just 5 minutes ahead, right past Momo the monster, this side of the tilt-a-whirl. She's not about to tell you anything you don't already know. She'll be reading you cold, and it's nothing personal. Some you've been unlucky in love, topped off with, but not always. She can't lose. Even as we speak, someone's paying way too much again to be that unbelievably amazed by not nearly enough. You could do a whole lot better yourself, no matter whose hand you suddenly were holding. Forget her. Forget everything that comes after what I'm about to tell you. The bumper cars, the ring toss, the inscrutable wheel of fortune. Forget especially those 3 milk bottles. You could throw at those until you drop, never guessing your own strength. I'm risking my good name, lifted straight from this scale, Detecto, a precision instrument that really can substantiate the one thing I'm here to say. Believe me, the great Detecto can't possibly crystallize a single wisp of the future. This is about you and me right now, old-fashioned science and arithmetic in action. And because you have to give me 2 pounds, high or low, the target's bigger than it seems. The bowler trying to pick up the 5-pin imagines the fat middle of the pin itself, but his margin's actually the diameter of that ball to either side. It's not that tough when you think about it, standing there alone like that. Guessing any man's a snap, like dragging Main Street on Saturday at noon, no hands on the wheel. There's not one curve or hairpin turn that needs negotiating. Women, I approach from another direction entirely. I make sure to come in low, some crazy airplane kind of guess, flying underneath the radar, so they'll be less inclined to give themselves away by stepping onto the scale and proving once and for all how far I really can go wrong. Not for that ridiculously puny stuffed animal they'd get to walk away with. There's very little chance in my equation. This is a one-shot game of skill, and I'm the only one who plays. So whether or not I'm mostly on your $1 money, there aren't people hanging around all night, showing off, going broke, trying to impress what's left of their wives or the up-for-grabs boardwalk girls. There's no trading up for anything bigger, softer, better. There's no better luck next time. This isn't some clown shouting insults like, fathead or bag of bones from his seat above that laughable tank of water, and you can buy all the chances you need to drown him out with maybe just one lucky throw. Lit up in this relenting neon hubba hubba, it's no wonder people can't help themselves. My job's to insist they are exactly who they are, but only once. I'm the expert weighing in again, telling them what that means in pounds, the surest measure I know of the way a life accumulates. I say, this is how much of you matters tonight. I say, you've got absolutely nothing to be ashamed of, as if they'll truly feel more satisfaction in going away empty-handed. And when occasionally I miss my guess, whatever stuffed, stays stuffed that way forever in their no less disappointed hands. I've done the best I can do. They have at least that to carry with them. But I've got to be honest. Most nights I'm so good, it hurts. Just ask Madam Starlight, lately unlucky in making her customary small fortune. But not always. Her future here looks more promising without the predictably uninventive killjoy likes of me. I'm going to miss this crazy life on the edge of the only world there is. Most of all, the ocean at my back, swelling and rising and cresting, curling on itself until it breaks, that thunder in the surf drowning out another day's inconsequential noise, over and over, thousands of pounds of elemental grace under pressure. Next to that kind of power, anything we have to say is a word scrawled fast in the sand, and we're gone. And whatever's left behind is swallowed up, goes out to sea for a while, until it all comes crashing back in again, maybe changed, but no less broken. One more absurd picnic gone irretrievably to ruin. Stare at the flotsam long enough, and it sure enough takes on the unmistakable size and shape of just one person, wrecked on grief's high tide, knocked headlong in the undertow of desire. These are the ancient barnacled sorrows that followed us when we first bellied out of the water, grew legs, and walked away upright, trying never to look back. There are those days that get to us. We're down on our knees again, and here comes some wave that's been building for so long that by now it's packing the weight of the world. And that's what we'll be feeling. I'm afraid that's how we'd put it, too, if only we had the wind. Right here is where what's undeniably measured is measured for the next few hours at least, breath by goddamn living breath. I'm sizing it up here for everyone, in the blood, in the bone, in what passes finally for resolve, in the muscle of the jaw, in the neurons firing a few more of their desperate rounds before the swinging door in the brain comes unhinged completely. Brick by human brick, the weight of the world is so much more than any watery figure of speech. It's easily as real as your astonished face. It's anybody's guess, and I've always said, there's nothing to it. You give me a lifetime in either direction, high or low, I won't miss. Tonight your dollar's in good hands, but tomorrow none of this is any of my business. Tomorrow, like it or not, your guess is as good as mine. Wait, guests are retired, and tonight, at least from the St. Louis venues, I will retire this poem. I apologize for people who will have to hear it one more time. But I must read it tonight for my friends Becky and Connor Shaw. It's called America's Bed and Breakfasts. I'm not a big fan of the bed and breakfast. I know it's supposed to be a selling point to the weary traveler on the road to provide him or her some comfort in a more personal way. This is called America's Bed and Breakfast. It's dedicated in the poem text to G. Barnes, a man who was coordinating a reading tour of mine out west, who met me at the airport and who said, I've read your stuff and I've got a feel for who you must be and I apologize, but in one town we had to get you into a bed and breakfast. America's Bed and Breakfast. Even though I'm only staying the night, I have a sinking feeling there's going to be trouble. The real guests are talking it up in the living room, as if this is truly the life. What more could people want this far from home than to have every bit of their weariness and hunger taken so personally? Why would anyone settle for less? When they checked in and filled out the card with way too much space for "Tell us all about yourself," I bet they were more than happy to oblige. I can hear them, even now, while I'm writing down the only thing I'm sure of after my name and my actual address. I can already tell there's no way I deserve this kind of attention. I travel for the thrill of asserting what I can't be expected to know. Because I enjoy the molecular rearrangement that being a stranger occasions, I don't want to feel as if I'm somehow fitting into the familiar chambers of my life one more time. It's as if my Aunt Ida suddenly was named the nation's hotelier, and from now on there'll be no such thing as too much potpourri. Too many of those giant ceramic pitchers on hallway tables, dried flowers sprouting from the mouths of all the usual antiques in the land. Aunt Ida in St. Louis, Salt Lake City, Sausalito, New Orleans, Aunt Ida beckoning from every porch swing throughout charm-smitten New England. It's not enough that this place has taken its name from some official roster of the atmospherically correct. No, each room has its own ambiance spelled out. The salt air, the espresso, the Battle of Gettysburg room. And there's no Major Hoople from my Sunday Funny's childhood showing me the way, guiding star of our boarding house in resplendent fez, calf-calfing through adventure after unlikely adventure. No, my hosts are gentle Dick and Jane, grown serious and pale after too many years of rehabbing their straight and narrow world. 10 minutes of this, and my own color's fading. I'm already losing sleep I hadn't even thought of yet. I'm actually on my knees, despairing, in front of the shelf or two of books they insist on calling the library. Soil conservation, local histories, the requisite wisdom of Edgar Guest. I grab the Boy Scouts survival handbook because now the other guests are chummied up around the piano, lost in a spirited medley of show tunes, and I'm afraid it only gets worse. Some trigger-happy soul's bound to pull out a guitar, squeeze off a few rounds of Michael, Row the Boat Ashore, and then it's kumbaya before you know it. Now I'm turning my polite version of a pillow over and over, looking for the cool side. I'm really expected to sleep through this night, to wake up for breakfast. Fresh squeezed juice, something like scones, a china cup of exotic decaffeinated coffee, while all these slap-happy pilgrims talk about what's next. The Eichhorns will be, as always, irrepressible. They're excited about meandering through another farmer's market. Nancy and Donna can't wait to be in a boat on the lake. And Dick and Jane might smile and wonder out loud, what could possibly be in store for Mr. Misanthrope? As if I didn't have enough to answer for already. I can dream, can't I? There's a sleepy 1950s aqua-trimmed motel, its vacancy still radiant in neon. The guy at the night desk doesn't want to talk about politics or love, much less about his hula girl tattoo. He doesn't give a damn if I'm in town, on legitimate business, on the lam, on account of any sunburned Donna. And the unassuming key he hands over lets me into the cradle of civilization as I've come to know it room, where I kick off my shoes with impunity and warm up the TV, caressing its lovely rabbit ears. My kind of night already. Later, I'm walking the grounds with that plastic bucket in my hands, drawn to the all-night humming of the ice machine, its cold beauty, the surest sustenance around. In moments, I'll have something to carry with me for as long as it lasts. Finally, something to give away when people come asking. And I can get more if I have to. I can give them all they want. Because sometimes it's hard to remember exactly who you are, what you're doing anywhere. That's when I least believe in talking it out or sleeping it off or passing it around a table like bread till everyone's had his fill. And even if we are supposed to feel like part of the same ridiculous family, no matter how big, how impossibly happy, I can't imagine for the life of me why people would choose to make themselves this much at home, singing along through endless verses full of those monotonous assurances. No one's a stranger to suffering, but neither will we be strangers forever to the blessings that seem a little far away to me right now. Okay, so maybe just one more time. River Jordan is chilly and wide. Bed and breakfast on the other side. I can't believe the face on Mars is both a truism and the title of this poem. People familiar with the Martian face, the alleged Martian face, perhaps constructed by an ancient civilization. This was pretty much poked into the ground by, it existed since 76 when a few enterprising engineers and scientists discovered this face. 20-some years later, last year, there was another Martian probe that had higher resolution shots in on the same territory. Do folks know about this? It's in the, and it seemed to be just a pile of dirt, really. But the conspiracists can't ever quite let go of that. This is less about the conspiracists, and finally, I hope, ends up being a kind of love poem. You'll hear a few names, Adamski, Menger, Van Tassel, Angelucci. These were four gentlemen in the 1950s in the more innocent days of flying saucers before the aliens put probes up our noses and kidnapped us and stole ova and sperm. These were just aliens that invited humans to ride around on the spaceships. So they appear in here. I can't believe the face on Mars for Patricia. And we'll start with an infomercial. Everybody knows what those are. Some guy has really bought half an hour of TV time to talk about a photo beamed back by the Viking probe over the red plains of Cydonia, where, to hear him tell it, an ancient Martian race has painstakingly fashioned a monumental human face. It's 2 a.m., and he isn't saying why, but he's hawking his homemade book about what has to be, he insists, the most amazing find of the millennium. And because I can't believe the face on Mars is anything more than a freakish accident of light and shadow, I guess I'm getting hopelessly old. As a kid, I took it all as gospel. UFOs, abominable snowmen, Atlantis, ESP, ghosts, but especially UFOs. I wanted to imagine some other life possible worlds away from mine. I needed something flying in the face of the ordinary, so I believed at once in everything inexplicable and in nothing I might actually get used to. Arithmetic, piano lessons, religion, undeniable love. These days, we're mostly so sophisticated, it's frightening. We've got acres of the latest radio telescopes scanning the heavens for the same old miraculous sign. Pitch-perfect computerized signals going out by the thousands, wave after differentiated wave, into the vast desolation of space, on the off chance of discovering that finally, we are not alone. All that, and my Martian scholar friend can't see me making my own faces, can't hear me sighing out loud in my living room. It's unmistakable, the desperation in his face that says we spend our lives looking for clues that might give us enough to go on. But we always see more or less than what we want to in the extravagant night sky, in photos from millions of miles away, in the smoky haze of whatever rooms we're up too late in again. It might as well be my father's face, all business, the telltale serious crease in the brow. In the few grainy photos I have of him, he's somewhere in the gray hills of Pennsylvania, stiffly posing, off by himself, looking as if he'd rather be anywhere else right now, forever. The off-camera voice assures me, the face I should be seeing close up now stretches over a mile of rugged terrain, clearly a sign of constructive, intelligent life, a fierce, enigmatic labor of love. It's obvious this face has become his whole life. No wonder it seems so long. No wonder I can barely make out anything at all. It pales next to those exuberant faces of flying saucer zealots in the 50s, George Adamski, Van Tassel, Orfeo Angelucci, Howard Menger. I couldn't get enough of their colorful antic tales of contact with actual flying saucer pilots who'd traveled from unbelievable places just to deliver some cornball message to all humanity. Through these even more unlikely accidental earthling go-betweens. It happened, almost always, telepathically. Whether landing in Newark or the middle of nowhere California desert, they didn't have to say a word. But their fledgling emissaries had to, in treatise after crackpot treatise, how they never saw it coming, they never asked for it, the improbable physics, mysterious gestures, the hyperbolic beauty of the female crew that always seemed to manage to figure in their breathless recountings. And although invariably they were left to take the long walk back to their rooming houses, to their penny ante labors, they honestly seemed to believe themselves less alone. And being only human, they had to talk about it. In Secret of the Saucers, inside the spaceships, from outer space to you. In wild-eyed books with their own amazing faces staring out from the covers. With time running out, the guy trying to sell me that Martian face turns into every salesman in the world who senses the door slamming shut. He resorts to the quick pitch, seeing is believing. But I bet he understands it usually works the other way around, like this. Probably I'm seeing things I've gone too long without. And because I believe they're finally possible again, they are undeniably here. No spectral head of Elvis, no Scottish lake monsters, out of focus Bigfoot. At the moment, I can't even summon up the face of a single waitress who ever said she'd be right back with more coffee in my lifetime. But I have been seeing more of those flashing lights, those odd shapes moving at impossible speeds, the unidentified flying objects of love coming in so quietly for a landing through the dark my life's been lately. And now it's that fabled beam of light from the vicinity of the bedroom and you stepping suddenly out of it, radiant in your skin. Even if it's true they never saw it coming, I think Adamski and the rest had to be asking for something, secretly at least, at night with no one around, surely no less a version of prayer than any other. In the desert, in the woods, in a deserted New Jersey industrial park, they offered it up in the general direction of heaven, and they couldn't wait for some kind of answer in the thick of their lives. And let's face it, When the answer came to them, no matter how far-fetched, yes, they were surprised, but not completely. And if those saucers' disciples were right about the telepathic powers, then you're sure to be thinking what I'm thinking. Where you've come from is less important by far than what we're climbing into, wherever it's headed now. I'm on board for the long haul, the giddy light years, no matter the unlikely physics, no matter the complex machinery, the inexplicable engines of the heart. Finally, I'm getting the benevolent message directly. Sometimes we are not alone. It almost got lost in those saucer books amid the vagaries of love and universal understanding, the convoluted discussions of how we might yet be saved and just in time from some worst part of ourselves. No beings could ever have traveled all that way thinking any of this would be easy. They must have hoped against hope they'd be lucky enough to find the one person in the world this time who, believe it or not, would believe it when he met them face to face. Maybe that's all this guy on TV's wanted. He's just gone off the air, but a toll-free number keeps flashing, as if he'll be up all night knowing what he knows, and how can anyone else sleep either? Last night, I watched you sleeping, illumined in the streetlight through the bedroom window, our reliable neighborhood moon. And for a minute, I couldn't believe the grace in your cheekbones, your flickering eyes, the gentle slope of your chin right under that otherworldly smile. I couldn't believe my own eyes. I had to touch you to make sure you simply were, that it wasn't just me in the leftover light from stars no longer actually themselves in the sky. And it wasn't just me. The entire universe took a deep breath, let it slowly out again, an astronomical sigh of relief. What could it hurt to call? Tell him yes, if it means so much to him, he's right. There is a face on Mars beyond the shadow of a doubt. I never really meant to believe otherwise. At least I can see that much now. Like to close with the musicians. This poem closes down the Conspiracy Quartet, the book-length poem. CIA, Roswell, Uncle Bud, finally, you, the reader, are, of course, implicated too. The poem is called The Accomplice. This poem isn't an intricate theory years in the making. This poem can speak only for this poem. This poem will tell you it's not what you think. This poem is nothing more than a series of coincidences. This poem is no secret prototype the government is testing. This poem has a lot of powerful friends behind it. This poem is something you'd be happier not knowing. This poem is murder on reliable eyewitnesses. This poem is counting on your complete cooperation. This poem can put you at the scene of untold crimes, or this poem is your ironclad alibi, depending. This poem doesn't want anything to happen to you. This poem hopes you get the message, although this poem has no explicit message of its own. This poem can't promise it will bail you out. This poem won't even remember you. This poem is well aware of the statute of limitations. This poem means what it says. This poem means anything you need it to. This poem has seen things hard to believe. This poem is all you have to believe. This poem has implications. This poem couldn't possibly be. This poem is so good it ought to be illegal. This poem is the only hard evidence recovered. This poem has your prints all over it. This poem has recently been discharged. This poem is not a disgruntled loner acting spontaneously. This poem has been seen consorting with other known poems. This poem has Confederates in top floor windows all over the city. This poem never goes by the same name twice. Poem has no highly trained Russian look-alike. This poem never receives specific instructions. This poem has nothing better to do. This poem can hit you where you live. This poem seldom misses at that kind of distance. This poem has its story down cold. This poem doesn't want to have to say it more than once. This poem has never seen its share of the money. This poem is just the patsy. This poem laughs at the witness protection program. This poem wants immunity before it starts naming names. This poem isn't taking the fall for anyone. This poem has you exactly where it wants you. This poem you think you're getting to the bottom of right now. This poem that's taken you into its confidence. This poem that's made you an accomplice after whatever the fact. This poem suggesting in so many words it's always been on your side. This poem doesn't make those kinds of mistakes. This poem will give you up every time. Thank you.